Hi, I'm Dr. Chris Cannon, and on behalf of CME Outfitters, I'd like to welcome you and thank you for joining us in today's educational activity. This activity is brought to you by CME Outfitters, an award-winning accredited provider of continuing medical education for clinicians across the globe. There are several really neat features that are being offered by CME Outfitters. They're providing resources for both patients and providers. So first, CME Outfitters would like to try and integrate digital health tools, and so they partnered up with a group called Pack Health, and will offer to 75 patients personalized digital health coaching for up to 3 months. Then for clinicians, CME Outfitters will be offering an e-consult service at no cost for up to 100 clinicians who sign up. The group Arista MD will be providing the e-consult service to clinicians at no cost for a 30-day period. And then finally, CME Outfitters has developed two patient education tools. One really nice whiteboard animation that describes non-valvular atrial fibrillation, its symptoms, risk factors, and treatment, as well as a downloadable list of questions that the patient could ask their doctor or healthcare professional regarding non-valvular atrial fibrillation. So, want to introduce us as a group. My name is Chris Cannon. I'm the education director at the Cardiovascular Medicine Institute, or Innovation, at Brigham and Women's Hospital, and a professor at Harvard Medical School. And looking forward to an active discussion that will focus on strategies and tools for improving care. And we'll begin with a good friend, colleague, and world expert, Dr. Elaine Heilig, who's the director of the Thrombosis and Anticoagulation Service at Boston Medical Center and a professor of medicine at Boston University School of Medicine here in Boston. Also want to introduce Dr. Deepak Bhatt, another good friend and colleague, and he's the executive director of interventional cardiovascular programs at Brigham and Women's Hospital and the Heart and Vascular Center, and also a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. So want to welcome both of you for this terrific program, and we look forward to being a global community with all of you who are joining online. And what we'll be talking about first is a segment to look at how to identify high-risk patients who could develop non-valvular atrial fibrillation in our practices. So the learning objective of this segment is to examine the significance of identifying patients at high risk for developing non-valvular atrial fibrillation in a primary care setting where they then might benefit from anticoagulation therapy. So we'll begin with a question for everyone, and you'll see on the screen here a question of which of the following is unlikely to be part of the clinical presentation of a patient with atrial fibrillation. A is headache, fatigue, lightheadedness, no symptoms, or I'm not sure, and put don't know. So if you can answer, we'll come back to these in just a second. So we'll begin with prevalence. Elaine, perhaps you could start us off with looking at this really a classic slide of looking at the prevalence over age of atrial fibrillation.
Sure, Chris. So I think this is really the reason that we're here today. The prevalence of atrial fibrillation actually increases with age. As you can see on this slide, which is a study that came out of the Kaiser Permanente in California, Northern California, and you can see that the prevalence actually, once we hit ages of 75 up to 80, really start to increase, I think, quite dramatically, 7%, 10%, 11%, actually higher estimates have come out in even more recent studies on prevalence, upwards of 15% of individuals over age 80. These are patients in my practice. I see this demographic a lot. Another important, interesting fact that I don't think we fully understand is why men at any age seem to have more risk of developing atrial fibrillation. But with that being said, if you look at the older age groups, I mean, women numerically end up having more numbers of AF because we tend to still be living longer. And women actually have a higher risk of stroke in AFib. So it's, you know, we can't be forgetting women in atrial fibrillation because I think overall it affects really all of us as we get older.
Yeah. It's a striking thing. And I guess the other part of this is that there are a lot of people that have AFib, but we just don't know it. And do you want to comment on the underdiagnosed patient?
Right. So, you know, the question that you had asked our audience was, what are the symptoms of atrial fibrillation? And I think this is the real challenge in general medicine primary care, because oftentimes patients don't know that they're in atrial fibrillation. Many studies have shown, you know, maybe 10 to 12% in the cardiovascular health study actually knew, these patients knew they were in AF. There are some symptoms that might trigger you thinking about atrial fibrillation, but let me just say that most patients don't even appreciate that they're in it. And here on this slide, I think it's provocative, because when we look at the undiagnosed AF, these are not small numbers. It's not 1% or 2%, and it's about 11% overall, 1 in 10, maybe even 1 in 9, 1 in 8 of us is sort of running around not appreciating that we're in this rhythm. And it especially, certainly most important, I think, in the older age group, over 65, 70, because that's when we start to see the stroke risk increase as well.
Wow. And we've talked about prevalence as sort of a snapshot. What about lifetime risk, Deepak? That is even probably greater than what we get at a snapshot.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's really the million-dollar question, in a sense, especially from a patient's perspective. And this slide really nicely shows what the lifetime risk is for atrial fibrillation. And it's pretty high in men, it's pretty high in women, it's pretty high, in fact, at all ages. It's true there's a lot more of it in general as people get older. But even if you talked about men and women greater than or equal to the age of 40, one out of four, essentially a quarter of them, will develop atrial fibrillation. So that just shows you what the lifetime burden is of atrial fibrillation. And another way of looking at that is that there's a 1 in 6 lifetime risk of developing atrial fibrillation if one is currently free of it. So bottom line is probably one of us is going to develop atrial fibrillation. It's just how the numbers work out.
Yeah. And I guess this has been something that I certainly am seeing just in my practice. Almost everyone seems to have AFib. Of course, that's not the case. But has it been changing over time?
Yes, you can see even from the slide that's being shown now that the prevalence of atrial fibrillation has been rising in the United States, and it's estimated that it's going to increase by about twofold by the year 2030, such that over 12 million people have atrial fibrillation. And in fact, atrial fibrillation is a global problem. The slide shows the United States, but this is true throughout the world, as you know, people are living longer, and that's the case in the U.S., but it's in fact true everywhere in the world, really. So there's
right,
going to be a lot
I
more
think,
AFib.
You know, another important point here is that, you know, we're living longer. We're actually seeing 80s and 90s now. The definition of elder, I think, has recently changed. And, you know, as we're living longer with our hypertension, with our high cholesterol, hopefully living longer with our diabetes and the metabolic syndrome, that we're seeing this phenomenon of something that happens within our hearts and our vasculature. And clearly obesity is another really important factor in this. I don't want to use the word epidemic, but we need to help our patients develop healthy lifestyles, weight loss programs, because, I mean, there are some real risks to being obese, and that's underlying some of this expansion.
Yeah, and I'd say that's probably underappreciated in terms of a risk to develop atrial fibrillation, but, you know, well seen. Certainly then, once you have atrial fibrillation, the outcomes are what we worry about, and stroke prevention is sort of key. But you have some neat data, Deepak, from the REACH registry on overall cardiovascular outcomes.
Sure. So these are data from the International REACH Registry, over 60,000 patients either with atherothrombosis or at risk for it. So having a history of things like prior history of angina or claudication, that sort of thing, or just patients with multiple risk factors like diabetes, hypertension. But at any rate, when one compares those with atrial fibrillation versus without atrial fibrillation, and here follows them for about 4 years or so, you can see there's about a twofold higher rate of cardiovascular death, MI, or stroke, so a doubling in the risk associated with atrial fibrillation here, going from about 13% to 24%. Now, not all that is caused by atrial fibrillation. That is, atrial fibrillation obviously can cause some proportion of cardioembolic strokes. It can cause the occasional MI from an embolus, for example, or type 2 MI just from a really fast heart rate. But What this is really showing us is that atrial fibrillation, apart from its being causative, as I mentioned, actually is associated with a lot of other similar risk factors for atherothrombosis, the things Elaine was just mentioning, things like hypertension, diabetes, for that matter, heart failure, obesity. They all tend to cluster together and go together. So if a patient has atrial fibrillation, obviously you want to focus on the atrial fibrillation as a modifiable risk factor for cardioembolic and systemic embolism. But on the other hand, one also realizes it's just a generalized marker of badness. Think about their other cardiovascular risk factors as well.
It's a terrific, you know, if it's 1 in 4 over a 4-year period, that's a pretty common problem that they're going to be facing some bad
Absolutely.
Outcome.
And then just to make clear, I may not have mentioned, these are stable outpatients who are enrolled in this registry. So these aren't hospitalized people that are really sick. They're just people sitting in the office feeling well.
Yeah. Well, what about the cost to the healthcare system? That's obviously, if it's tracking with their risk, the costs are going to be high.
Yeah, that's an important point. Obviously, in this country, we're in a continual debate about healthcare costs that are rising. How can we rein them in? And I'm not sure we'll figure that out in the next 45 minutes here, but atrial fibrillation is definitely a big part of that risk. You know, in the U.S., some figures are shown here on the slide. You can see really the costs go into the billions of dollars, consisting of inpatient atrial fibrillation costs, outpatient and pharmacy costs, and then various indirect costs associated with this. So, you know, in total, for example, data from 2005 shows a $26 billion cost associated to the system with that. And that's, of course, only gone up since that time because of the increased prevalence of atrial fibrillation and also some newer therapies for it. So lots of cost to atrial fibrillation beyond just the human cost of consequences such as stroke and other embolic problems. There's also just the financial cost.
Yeah, and I guess we also have seen the estimates of what would be the cost of all those undiagnosed patients, many of whom will first present with a stroke, where that, you know, can be a terrible outcome, but also obviously more cost to the health system.
Well, that's a great point, because that last slide was just capturing the cost of known treated atrial fibrillation. Yeah, the untreated part that presents as a disabling stroke wasn't captured in that slide.
Well, the risk stratification we talk about in a lot of diseases, but probably no better place here than in atrial fibrillation. Do you want to comment on the sort of evolution of our risk scores and what you use currently?
So, you know, it's important to remember that atrial fibrillation in and of itself increases the risk of stroke fivefold, roughly, no matter what age you are. But the reason that we don't, in the guidelines, don't really promulgate use of anticoagulation until you get into these other CHADS and CHAS-VASc risk factors is because it really tracks with these factors that are raising the hypercoagulability or the clotting of our blood. So the CHADS was what we were originally using. That was really heart failure, hypertension, age over 75, diabetes, and prior stroke, with prior stroke always being 2 points. We've since moved on to a CHADS-VASc stroke risk scoring scheme, which basically now includes age 65 to 74 as a point, which clearly makes sense because we don't suddenly have our 75th birthday and have this risk of stroke. It's a continuum. And we also included females, so women, especially if you're over 65, some probably menopausal effects on our platelets and other things. And then in addition to that, the CHADS-VASc, that vascular part of it is really incorporating atherosclerosis, so peripheral arterial disease, coronary artery disease. And I think that's important because there's inflammation that can actually track systemically with those entities and I'm sure also increases the risk of stroke. You know, I think that probably the biggest advantage of this CHADS-VASc score is it enabled us to really discriminate across 9 points the risk of a stroke and atrial fibrillation such that, you know, the lowest risk, we really now, I think, have a handle on the lowest risk group of individuals, and that's what this CHADS-VASc helps us do. So, you know, globally, we now, all of the groups are embracing the CHADS-VASc score. And I think, you know, we will be going over, you know, when to anticoagulate subsequently. But, you know, once you hit a CHA2DS2V score of 2, and you can see the points assigned for each of these, that's really considered absolutely you really need to be discussing and prescribing an anticoagulant for those patients.
Well, it's terrific, and this has really been a wonderful evolution. We saw an interesting study looking at this in the undiagnosed, at least, AFib patient, and this also seems to track in terms of the percentage of patients who have higher scores.
Right, and this, biologically, we all went to medical school. I mean, this makes sense to me that, you know, if you think that there are some changes that are occurring within the left atrium, like fibrosis, inflammation, that those factors may be triggering this unstable or this arrhythmia, this atrial fibrillation. So it doesn't really surprise me that when you look at those individuals without AFib, but you look at their CHA2DS2V scores or their CHA2DS2V scores, that within that highest risk population who you might be thinking of screening, and here you can see this study where 56% of undiagnosed cases had a CHA2DS2V score of 2 or greater, and 77% had a CHA2DS2V score of 1 or greater. And what I failed to mention on the previous slide is that what is the stroke risk then? And this is really the bottom line. Is that with the CHA2DS2V score, you can appreciate here if your score is 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, or 9, you can, the annual risk of an ischemic stroke, even if your CHA2DS2V score is 4, is already at about 8%. If you're looking at a CHA2DS2V score, you know, even at 2, which seems like, well, you know, Elaine, that seems awfully low. Why are we giving, you know, these blood thinners? It's a risk of maybe 4%. That's 4 out of 100, 2 out of 50, 1 in 25 that may have a stroke. And again, remembering the bottom line with these strokes is that they're associated with the 24% mortality at 30 days. So, you know, Chris, these are not just small, like minor strokes where you're like, most of these, I won't say most, let's say 24% of the time, these strokes are devastating enough that individual's no longer with us in 30 days. And for me, that's the bottom line.
Yeah. Well, let's circle back to the clinical presentation. And Deepak, what kind of things do you actually look for risk factor symptom-wise for patients sort of screening, so to speak, for AFib?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think, you know, again, a bottom line perspective would be that there's just a lot of symptoms that atrial fibrillation can be associated with. And as we alluded to before, of course, there's a lot of people out there with asymptomatic atrial fibrillation. And even the asymptomatic part can be pretty bad and causing problems to the myocardium that the person is completely unaware of because they're asymptomatic. So, you know, that's an important part of it all. But in terms of presentations, you know, palpitations is what a lot of times we think of and ask about. But there's really just a lot of other things, too. Dyspnea can occur, chest pain, of course, lightheadedness, syncope, fatigue. And of course, there are a lot of things that cause fatigue, but in an older person who is fatigued and sort of it's out of the blue without another good explanation, hopefully someone thinks to, you know, check the heart rate and rhythm. Obviously, thromboembolism is the feared complication of atrial fibrillation, and as Elaine pointed out, there's a proportion of that that'll be fatal. So that's really the challenge with atrial fibrillation. So screening for symptoms can be useful, and you know, these are all things that would be asked for in a typical primary care or wellness visit. But on the other hand, it's easy to miss atrial fibrillation.
Yeah. Well, this kind of brings us back to the question that we posed, and we do have some answers. Again, the question was which of the symptoms was unlikely to be part of the clinical presentation, and so the audience answered 45% headache, and so that's the right answer. That's not a typical presentation, but then fatigue and lightheadedness, no symptoms at all were noted in 21%, but that is a common finding that people just will show up. I've had that in the office that suddenly I look down at their EKG and they're in AFib and they're just chatting with me about their cholesterol. Right. And it's like, wait a minute, we've got a whole other thing we've got to worry about. So I think it's a good thing for us to remember that it's sort of a vague presentation. It's not sort of a classic MI type. Well, thank you all very much for joining today's program. It's been a delight doing it with you.
Thank you.